Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Suzy Yang, author of White Ivy, her first novel, which will be released in November by Simon & Schuster. So Suzy obtained her doctorate in pharmacy and then launched a tech startup. But she studied creative writing at Tin House, my favorite, and Sackett, and then came White Ivy, one of Glamour's best books of 2020, and lots of other praise. So White Ivy is a book that defies genres, going from one of immigration story to love story to thriller to psychological drama. Our protagonist, Ivy, is a difficult character to navigate. The reader is like tossed a bit by the waves that shape her worldview and the actions that are propagated by them. Born in China and taken care of by her grandmother, Mei Feng, who I love, her parents, Shen and Nan, eventually save enough to bring her to the States to join her brother, Austin. Ivy's youth shapes a lot of her later life, and the reader is drawn to the curve of that life, which is definitely not a straight line. So surprises abound, and I'll try not to give any away. So with that, welcome, Suzy, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sam. That was a really good description.
Thanks. Well, so because I own a bookstore, I'm always interested in the cover, and then I'm always interested in the epigraph, because as many people who say you can't judge a book by its cover, everyone who comes into my store will,
right.
Without exception. And then they look at the epigraph. So this is the cover here. This is as good as I can do. And so I was going to ask you, what did you vet the cover? Did you design it? You did?
Oh, I definitely did not design it. Simon & Schuster designed it. Yeah. We got a couple. I think my editor sent me over, I want to say 5 different designs initially, and they were all really different. And then, you know, we kind of went back and forth a few times, and then a lot of other people weighed in. And I think this version ended up being a combination of 2 other versions that we really liked. I really am drawn to black and white covers with like a little splash of color. And I know this because every time I go to the bookstore, I browse the books, and I always find myself picking up the black and white cover with like, you know, something very mysterious looking on it. So clearly this cover is designed for me. So I think, and then we kind of played with the font a little bit and the placement, but I think this was maybe after 3 rounds of feedback, we got this cover that everybody was happy with.
The woman on the cover kind of looks like you.
Everyone said, my friends are like, is this you? I'm like, no.
The interesting thing I find on the cover is that when you look at, well, it's a great cover, and you know, the way the rip is across gives this dichotomy, but when you look at her, you see, I think, like this really confident look and almost defiant, right?
Yeah, her arms are crossed.
Yeah, like, don't get anywhere near me.
Yeah, and I also love that you don't see her eyes. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah, it's so funny because like now with COVID, all you see is eyes. And unless you have laughing eyes, and so do I. And I don't know, like if I go to the doctor and I say something to the receptionist, like, can't believe you're still working here. I don't know whether she thinks I'm being a jackass or whether she thinks it's funny.
Yeah, you can't read people well. Yeah, it's harder to read people.
Well, so getting into the book, the epigraph. So the epigraph is, the snow goose needs not bathe to make itself white. So you must have thought about that a long time, I assume. You go ahead, because you have the answer. I don't.
I was gonna say, I think I must have Googled and cataloged something like hundreds of Chinese proverbs, searching for the perfect one that would kind of fit the theme of the book, but also tie into the title. And I went through so many. And then we came up with this one, and then this one tied into the title really nicely, which is White Ivy. And so the title White Ivy comes from this phrase, the snow goose do not bathe to make itself white. And it really speaks to kind of Ivy's desire for legitimacy. You know, it's the whole idea of, are you born a certain way, or do you make yourself a certain way, and what is intrinsic versus extrinsic? So I thought that quote was really fitting for the book. And then that's where the title actually is pulled from as well.
Well, it kind of reminds me of the idea of gilding the lily. Like, you don't have to, because it's already.
Yes, yes, exactly. Anything, yeah.
Anything you do to it is going to just kind of mess it up or make it something different. So right. why then is she White Ivy, and she doesn't have to work to become White Ivy?
I think to me, it speaks to the fact that she wants to be that type of person. So she has her intrinsic values, right? She has intrinsic worth. But she wants something different, and she admires the people who don't have to try hard to be that. Do you know what I mean? So it's like she's aspiring to something that's unattainable, because she wants something that comes naturally to others, but it doesn't come naturally to her. But she wants to be the sort of person where that would come naturally to. And I think that whatever it is in her mind, you know, whether it's whiteness or privilege or money, but whatever that, you know, elusive goal is, that's what she aspires to. So I think the quote is, it kind of speaks to an unattainable thing. It's like looking at afar and you think, oh, those people, they have it so easy. You know, they're just born that way. But, you know, you're born a certain way, but she doesn't value those things. So I quite like that quote, because of all the different meaning. Yeah.
And it actually describes a lot of the people in the book, whether you're talking about Gideon, is he this or is he that?
Right, right.
The entire Spire family, you know, first I thought one thing about him, and then I thought, oh, they're not. Before I go off on all kinds of tangents, but since the book's not out yet, no one's read it, so I'm only asking questions about, you know, what I thought about it. I'll do two more, and then I can ask you to tell a little bit about the book, because that's what we're here for. But I love Mei Fang, because she's a driving force for Ivy throughout the book. And see, what I didn't mention in the introduction is it's also funny. So,
thank you.
my favorite part is when Mei Feng tells her how to switch price tags. Which, okay. So, tell us a little bit about the book. Oh, wait. Before that, another one. So, is Ivy beautiful in the physical sense? Is that how you imagine her? Because it's hard for the reader to know.
That's so interesting. I think she grows into it. Yeah, I think as a kid, maybe she feels more plain. You know, she doesn't have the adornments of a teenager. But I think as she gets older, she understands how to signal, you know what I mean? Signal beauty and signal cultivation. So yeah, I picture her attractive in like a very cultivated kind of way.
Oh, much more like at the party when, you know, the founder of the company's wife comes and meets with her. And she has really good eyelashes.
yeah. I think I do write that a few times, yes.
So tell us a little bit about the book in general then.
Yeah, so White Ivy, it follows our protagonist, Ivy Lynn, from when she's 14 to 27, and she falls in love with the son of a state senator who goes to her private school as a child, and then they reconnect again as adults. And so the story really explores how far Ivy is willing to go to kind of get what she wants, which is access to this world that Gideon represents to her of money, privilege, class, you know, things that she aspires to, but doesn't necessarily feel like she has. And, you know, no spoilers. Essentially, we see the way that she manipulates people and the way that she adapts herself to her environment, all to achieve this very singular purpose of marrying to the Spire family.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because, you know, one of the reviews said that she sinks her claws into Gideon. And I thought about that for a while, and I'm thinking, I don't know if that's exactly what she does. And then the idea of her being a thief and being introduced on the first page, that's basically the first sentence. Yeah, it is the first sentence. But I thought about her attraction to Gideon and how she went to the party and things didn't work out. And so Rue, is that how I pronounce it, Rue?
Yes.
Rue gets involved. So like the novel is quite circular, because the only reason Rue gets involved is because of rejection by Gideon, correct?
Yes.
and then it comes back full circle.
Yes.
It's almost like a book like Of Human Bondage or something like that, where you should go after the person you want to go after, but you end up going after somebody else.
Yeah, if only we all wanted what was good for us, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing about Ivy, is that she could make the right decisions. Mm-hmm. And there are books like that too, but she chooses. Well, you know, the question is, really, does she either despise her or you understand her? Mm. Probably few people actually like her.
Mm.
And so is her character, because of the way she was brought up, just like maybe like Austin's character, or is her character something that she really strived for?
I think it's a combination of both. I think that both her personality, which is probably inherent, and also the circumstances in which she was raised, like such as Mayfong's influence or, you know, her immigrant background, I think the alchemy of those two kind of created her very specific character, in my mind at least. I wanted to show that. I think that, for example, Austin and Ivy, you could say, were raised very similarly in the same family, and he turned out very different. And so I wanted to show both her personality, which is, you know, already very impressionable, very aspirational. She has a very vivid imagination. She's always longing for something that she doesn't have, that restless sense. And that is fueled with her circumstances, you know, growing up as a Chinese American immigrant in a very low income apartment housing, but then going to a very wealthy private school and saying, oh, wait, I don't have what those people have. So I think it's the alchemy of that created her, her very unique worldview and the way that she makes decisions that are very unique to her. I think it's shaped by both her character that she was born with, but also the circumstances around her childhood.
Well, when you talk about the difference between Austin and mm-hmm. Ivy, their upbringing was similar. There's other reviews that say that there's this, I guess, thread of subtle racism throughout the novel,
mm-hmm.
which I wouldn't necessarily agree with. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that. Do you think that's true?
I haven't read the review. Is it like racism toward is it like she doesn't like being Chinese? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, no, this review, and I wish I had it in my hand, was basically saying, like many immigrant stories about Chinese, there's this subtle knowledge by people that there's something different, or I need to act differently because she's Chinese.
Oh, like she, like Ivy experiences racism.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. I see. I don't know if I intentionally, you know what I mean? I definitely didn't intentionally set out to portray those, you know, subtle threads, but maybe it comes off across just because you assign certain, I mean, everyone forms impressions, right? We make assumptions about each other. And I think maybe some of those assumptions, because Ivy is Chinese, like it can be attributed to the fact that she's a Chinese immigrant. But I definitely don't think I intentionally wrote a scene or a character that was very overtly racist toward Ivy because of the fact that she's Chinese. Yeah, I don't think I did that on purpose.
I have two Chinese children we adopted from Xi'an, and I think it's Jiangxi City, but Samantha and Annie, her name is Ann Tata because of the two towers in Xi'an. And she was born, you know, where the terracotta soldiers are. So we met the guy, the farmer who discovered him. And so the Chinese government has kind of like given him enough of a stipend that he sits there in a lawn chair all day and you can sit in his lap, you know, like Santa Claus. So I have a picture of that.
That's so funny.
But the one thing that I've noticed, because I always think, you know, that especially with all the books out now and with Black Lives Matter, I always see, okay, I guess I am kind of a racist. But the interesting thing about Samantha and Annie is I've never looked at them as being anything other than Samantha and Annie. So I have totally forgotten that they're Chinese. And then my friend Martin is Chinese, and whenever the four of us go out for dinner, they just assume he's their father. And I always go, why would they assume that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's really, I mean, especially now with the BLM movement and everything, and it's just a topic now, you know what I mean? Everybody's kind of almost like introspecting themselves. And when I wrote this book, I definitely didn't think that race was a big theme, at least not one I intentionally set out to write about. It was obviously it comes through because of Ivy's background, but in a way, I almost think of this as a very American novel, you know, social climbing, you know, she wants that WASP life. But I think there is a sense of Ivy's personality being the other. And I think that's a feeling that a lot of immigrants can relate to. But I mean, there's so many, how do I put it? Like everyone has their own Achilles heel, right? The reason why they believe others are judging them, et cetera. And for Ivy, I'm not sure that she ever internalizes being Chinese as one of them. I think she internalizes maybe being different or having grown up, you know, poorer than her classmates, or not having the same cultural understandings. But I don't know. But definitely when I was writing this book, I definitely didn't intend to deliberately say something, you know, profound or anything about race in that sense.
Yeah, it's like one of the differences, again, as I always do, bringing it back to me, is that when I was in China and adopting Annie, and we got lost, the driver got lost going to the orphanage, and he found a farmer who they were discussing. Yeah. But I thought they were screaming each other, and I was really scared, but they were just talking. Yeah.
My husband had a really similar experience when he met my parents for the first time. They were like, just asking me to come down for dinner. And he's like, are they mad at you? And I was like, no, why would you think that? They're just telling us to come down for dinner.
Yeah, and, well, that's funny because you have a dinner scene in the book when Shen, and it's just so funny when she looks at him, the father, and just says, how much does it cost? How much did this cost?
Yeah.
It's like, it's just a normal question, but nonetheless, it has all kinds of trappings for both races.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, again, what I was talking about in terms of the comedy. And that's the other thing with Shen and Nan, which may, in fact, just be a cultural thing or maybe because of the way they were. But at first, you think they're just being terrible about raising her and not being parental and not having any cares about her. But that evolves, too. It evolves for the reader. There certainly is an amount of caring there.
Yeah, I think that's quite, I think that's probably comes from the wisdom of me having grown up. I think just being raised Chinese American, there was, as a kid, you know, there's such a feeling of like, oh, your Chinese parents don't say I love you, right? They don't show love through physical caresses and things like that. But as I get older, you start to see all the ways in which they do show love for you, such as cooking for you or coming up. You know, Ivy's parents go and visit her in Boston and they bring her all the food and the way they provide for her financially. And I just feel like it is a different understanding of how love is expressed. And that's something I learned as an adult and also that Ivy's learned as an adult is how to see her family as people and who they are and not just through her own lens. That was part of her evolution as well in understanding her parents.
Yeah, and it was also interesting in the book that you see, but you only see like out of the corner of your eye, how they begin to make her parents, Shen and Nan, make a life for themselves and do better and better and be more successful. And it's kind of there, but you kind of see it out of the corner of your eye. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wanted it to, I kind of wanted to do, to have it be Ivy's blind spot because, you know, in her mind, it's like her parents are like fossilized, you know, as the people that they were when she's a kid. And so she doesn't even really understand that they're changing and evolving as well until one day she's like, wait a second, you know, they're different now. Their house is different. They're different people now too. Yeah.
So, and that goes to the spires because, originally, I thought, oh, these guys are multi-millionaires. And then I thought, well, are they really? And but you don't really say anything.
Right.
But you stick things in there. You go, it turns out they're renting the house, you know, and there's some threadbare things at the other house, summer house. But I don't know. And I don't want you to tell me. It's just that you leave the books always leave. Questioning certain aspects of it and also not knowing what's going to end. But
I think it was because I really wanted to the reader to be really close to Ivy's thought process. Like everything that we learn of the world is filtered through her eyes, and so she's wondering the same thing, right? Like how much money do these people have, you know, like where is their place in the hierarchy of American you know, patrician system. And because she's constantly looking for clues, we as the audience are also kind of following her to piece together the puzzle. And whether she ever discovers the truth, you know, or what their backgrounds are, or whatever it is that Ivy's looking for, I definitely didn't want my narrative voice to come in and say, actually, these are who these people are. I kind of did want to leave the audience feeling kind of seeing the world and the people through Ivy's eyes.
Yeah, and it's funny because from the first line, as I said earlier, the book really is a lot about money. Whether you are talking about Rue's end table, or whether you're talking about the present that Rue's boss gives to Ivy towards the end, or whether you're talking about Mei Feng explaining to Ivy exactly how you go about getting money and not even thinking that there's anything wrong with it. But yes, that thread of money runs throughout. In fact, even at the climax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's my personal. I don't know.
I didn't mean it that way.
No. I know what you're saying. Like, that's something that I think it was a reader discussion question. They said money is almost a character in this book. And I loved that. You know, it feels like it's its own, you know, it's its own shape-shifting character that other things revolve around and the characters revolve around. And it's really true. I felt, for me at least, it was a way to explore. It kind of represents so many things, right? Class and, you know, wealth and aspirations and freedom, beauty. So yeah, I really liked that. The fact that it is such a strong thread and almost a character of itself.
It is, because you gave it almost anthropomorphic aspects. Like when you talk about it was almost 2 inches thick.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and so the reader goes, okay, well, I did. I went like, okay, it's like that. And they're $100 bills, so I started adding it up in my head.
Did you get an amount? Because I don't know.
I did get an amount, and I thought, well, is that enough? I don't want to give anything away. But it's funny, like with Rue, he's all about money too. And it's almost, again, like a different immigrant story too.
Yeah, I think I use a line somewhere in there that they were like, that Ivy felt they were like two pirates. And I think I see that as a common thread. There's like a hardness, I think, in the both of them from, you know, whatever experience they've had or whatever their personalities are that binds them together, right? I think both of them can sense that in the other. This very like dog eat dog understanding of the world in a sense. And of course, so much of that has to do with money and material things, which they both do really covet. And that's, I think, the understanding. But on Ivy's part, it's understanding, but also probably contempt, because she doesn't want to be that type of person, even though she is, right? Whereas Rue freely acknowledges, yeah, I'm like this, I'm fine with it. So.
And it's funny with both Rue and Gideon. The part of money is also combined with one of them or the other saying, I love you. So.
Is that true? Oh my gosh.
Well, it's kind of vice versa with Gideon. It's hard for me not to give away.
Yeah. I'll go back and check. That's so interesting. That was not on purpose. I'll go back and check as well.
And the thing about it is too, when you were reading it, and because we have all our book clubs with these people, it's like, it harkens back to like Jane Austen or Bronte, almost like a period piece in which you could take those characters and change the time and where they were, and they have the same kind of characteristics, you know, like the young woman wooing the elder, much richer, you know, and vice versa. So, you know, at the very end, what happens at the very end, I started Googling movies in which that exact thing happens, and there's like 10 movies where that happens. Have you ever seen a movie where that happens?
No, the only where someone
don't give it away.
I won't. The closest I can think of is The Secret History, which I know some people have comped this book to. You know, obviously it's so iconic, but that's the one I can think of. I don't think I've ever seen any movies or that had that particular type of ending.
There's some recent ones, but I was trying to think of which one it is, but there's an old black and white one. It's like with either Cary Grant or Jimmy Stewart or someone like that. And they get, and that's my point, is because they are torn between the idea of doing this or doing that. Whereas Ivy has it planned, and there's never any hesitation, in her plan and how she's going to carry it off very well. And that's where it really does come into one of the genres that I mentioned at the outset.
I always knew that that was the finale of Ivy's development. You know, that was going to be the pinnacle of her journey and in this particular part of her life. So I think everything, for me at least, the storytelling that all came before that, to me, led up to that point where her decisions would be, you know, understandable, believable, you know, impactful. So I always knew that she was headed there.
Oh, so that's like one of the questions that every other interview will ask you. Did you think that last part, did the novel work its way backwards from that point that you did? You? Is that what happened?
I always knew, yeah. So I think when I was writing this book, the first sentence came to me first. Ivy Lyn was a thief. And then I always knew everything was going to happen. I knew the characters. I knew what she was going to do. It was like the vision, the big skeleton of the book had never changed from the first sentence. It was really just how to lay out, you know, each scene so that it, you know, had the most impact and was the most satisfying story reading experience. But yeah, all the beats, the different parts of her life, the things that would shape her, what she would do, that's never changed since I thought of the book.
Yeah, it reminds me of that, the Mr. Ripley book.
The Talent of Mr. Ripley.
Yeah, right. And so it's like, is she a sociopath?
That's such a good question. That's something that I actually grappled with when I was writing the first like 50 pages or so, because I thought, do I want to go down that route? You know, do I want to make this like a kind of psychological study of a sociopath? And I decided against that. I didn't want to kind of go down that like very, very noir path. I wanted it to kind of start almost very innocent and feel very coming of age. You know, you're with her, you understand her feelings of, you know, injustice and loneliness, but then as she progresses further along her ambitions, you start to see the cracks, I suppose. So I think I deliberately made a decision very early on to say, okay, I don't want to write a sociopath. I want to make her sympathetic as I possibly can under the circumstances.
Yeah. And two things, if I can keep them in my mind, I'm gonna write it down. One is the scene where, he says goodbye to Tom, in that getting says goodbye to Tom and then everything, whatever. So, and the other one is when Rue and Ivy kind of say goodbye to each other in a way, but there's all that goodbye is filled with threats. The goodbye between Gideon, to in a sense, and Ivy is just like, okay, I'm going to have to deal with this now. It's not going to change my relationship. I just have to deal with it.
With Gideon and Ivy when they say goodbye, or?
Yeah, well, I said it all wrong. What I mean is that scene where Ivy discovers something and.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
She discovers something and it's like, okay, got it.
Oh, I see. I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you. Yes. So the kind of the discrepancy between her different reactions.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I think the last part for me, I thought a lot about how she would react, you know, in that moment. And I think for me, that was sort of almost the death of Ivy. It was like almost like the death of Ivy's, like, I don't want to say individuality, but just her honesty in a way. Like, I think at that point she makes a conscious decision. I mean, she had that conversation with Sylvia, do you remember, in the dressing room?
Exactly.
Where basically Sylvia saying, like, you guys both like your life and it's fine because you found somebody to go on pretending with you for. And I think in that moment Ivy realizes, like, she chooses that pretend life over reality. And that to me was the point where she says, you know what, like, I've come too far. Like, I've done too much and I've sacrificed too much to get here. to say, actually, this is not what I want. And she commits fully to me, at least. That's when she actually kind of like loses whatever grasp on reality and fully embraces the persona, if you will, that she has created for herself and for her and Gideon's future. And I think that was a tone I wanted to end the novel with, which is, you know, this very sinister, like, yes, I'll choose this fake life, even if I have to pretend for the rest of my life, that this is real.
Which again, harkens back to the 19th century novel as well. But, you know, and then the other thing is that conversation with Sylvia, you begin to realize, which makes you feel a little bit more sympathetic towards Ivy, is that Sylvia is basically the same person, maybe not to the same degree, especially when that understanding arises between them, not one that Sylvia is particularly, you know.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I feel like Sylvia is probably one of the most hated characters. I don't think I've had anybody be like, I really just really liked everyone, like really despises her.
At the very beginning of her relationship, Sylvia seems like a wonderful person.
Yeah. Very supportive.
They both have their agendas, that's for sure.
Yeah. I think that's a really good word. I definitely thought a lot about what are people's real agendas and why, like, what are they doing to cover that up and why? And I think a lot of people, most of the characters, at least in this book, I do feel like have their own agendas, as all humans do, right? Nobody is so purely honest with everybody. But I did, one of the more interesting, compelling things about writing this book was to show and reveal, you know, people's hidden agendas versus what they're portraying to the world. And then seeing how all those come together, that was really pleasurable for me.
Yeah, I think you're right that each of them, and that was something that came to me later in the book, is that, you know, all of these people have exactly an idea of where they're going, and none of it's necessarily going to be at the surface, except for, which is why I like her so much, Ivy's grandmother.
Yeah, she's too old. Maybe when she was younger.
Well, yes, she has her own backstory, too. That's very true. But now she is what she is. She's going to say what she says. Yeah, now that I get older, I feel the same way. Except most of the time, I feel like I'm invisible and no one listens to a word I'm saying. As my older daughter told me, she goes, look, Dad, you've lived your life. Now we have ours.
I mean, I do sympathize. I think I said something similar to my dad a few months ago, where I think I said something like, you have no more power.
I really didn't want to say that, but plus that depresses me that you said that. But
I mean, I was like, part kidding, part serious, and he just was so he was so annoyed.
Well, the other thing is, she says, and I'm sure you've heard, you've done this too, Dad, you've told me that story 100 times.
Oh yes. But that's natural. Honestly, I'm 32, and I have friends who already do that, so I don't even know that
really
with age. So.
I get told that too, which makes me feel a little better. But now I'm afraid to tell her anything.
She enjoys it. She enjoys teasing you, I'm sure.
She does. The nut doesn't fall far from the tree. Well, so one of the things I got at earlier, which is, I know a lot. Well, look, since we have all these book clubs, and this will definitely be in the book club. I call it Fight Club because.
Oh, I love that. That's awesome.
I always imagine like it's a table with two people on either side, and I feel like they want to crawl, get their claws into the other person. How can you like her? How can you think that he's doing what he's doing?
Wow, I want to join that book club. That sounds very exciting.
It's always all women, though. There's never a guy in there. And I'm not saying that in a chauvinistic way. It's true.
Yeah. There just
aren't any. But except in the nonfiction book club. They'll do that. But so what I was getting at earlier before I started talking about the book club is that some of them like books that end where the author says, okay, here's a box. I'm going to put the end in it, and then I'm going to wrap it up, and I'm going to tie it with a ribbon. And some people, you know, and that's fine if they want that. But also, you know, other readers want it to be wide open, and this one certainly is, because you don't know. Because in my mind, well, it's like where we are now in the real world with 23 days left to an election, that, you know, people usually have an idea of what's going on. And so people ask me five times a day, what do you think will happen? And I said, you know, I'm not the Oracle of Delphi. What do you think is going to happen? They don't know either.
Yeah.
And the famous Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. I'm old. I don't want to live in it. I want to live in really boring times. Mm. It's much easier.
Yeah. It's funny. I had always wanted to live in interesting times until recently. I think for me, it was maybe the past 2 years. I moved around so much and I always felt like I was trying to, you know, look for new experiences or novelty. And now I'm like, I'm tired. I think it's also because of, like, you said, this year, uncertainty is definitely the theme of 2020. Obviously, it's like uncertainty and anxiety, right? They like go hand in hand. Nobody likes uncertainty about the future, certainly not me. And so maybe I think that has a lot to do with, at least for me, the feeling of, oh, I just want things to be just peaceful, you know, predictable. It definitely, I think that's a sentiment that's shared even by young people.
There's already TV shows and books coming out about this. But when we get some perspective, if we ever do, about what this was, it's going to be fascinating for kids who can tell their kids that they were born in 2020. And it's funny because my granddaughter she's never lived outside of quarantine, essentially.
Wow. Oh, so she's a newborn. Yeah. I mean, God, these new parents this year, I cannot imagine.
No. It's a complete, you know, enough of that. It's like, I'm not going to say the new normal or a new world because it's everything you could say has become a cliche by now.
Yeah. And it's become a cliche so quickly. I think that's what shocks me is how quickly something that feels new, you know, 1 week and the next week, you're like, oh, this is accepted. You know what I mean? And it feels tiresome already. That's what surprises me, how quickly we adjust and, you know, a new normal, it appears, and then you start to feel tired again, you know?
Yeah. And the weird thing was, I was in Hong Kong on February 5th, and I'm looking at all these people, like everybody in China, where you see so many people in China wearing masks, mostly, I think, because of pollution. But I saw them all there, and I've always kind of laughed at it, especially in New York, to see one woman wearing a mask. I never thought I would see it this day.
And
when I came back from Hong Kong, no one checked me, no one stopped me at customs, no one was wearing a mask. Whereas they were already taking my temperature as I went up the escalator in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
All of which has nothing to do with selling your book or will make you any money.
Anyway, no, it's good. Good conversation. Yeah. This year is crazy.
Well, so I guess another question you'll always be asked is, and I think I had a dream about this, is what are you thinking about doing next, or have you already started it?
Book for my second book?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm like 200 pages, I think. I checked today, something around there, into the second book. So I've been working on it because I've been doing so many rounds of edits on this book. So then between the edits and then also this year in lockdown, you know, I just was trying to think about something else besides the news. So I've been working a lot. So I'm 200 pages in. I think it has similar themes in the sense, I feel like for me, at least, I didn't know what type of writer I was because I've only written one book. So it's hard to say if there's a pattern or if I'm going to be interested in the same thing. So what I found in writing the second book is that I am really drawn to the theme of identity, you know, the struggle with that. And just even reflecting on myself, it's like, oh yeah, of course, you know, I grew up in so many different cultures. Obviously that's something I would be interested in. So that's definitely a prominent theme, but the setting is, partly, you know, in the US as well. And then partly it takes place in Beijing in the Chinese entertainment industry. So, and it again, you know, has really similar explorations of people's surface agendas and then their inner agendas and how people can, you know, adapt the circumstances to get what they want. So it has similar themes, but you know, it's hard for me to say what it is overall yet because I'm like two thirds. So it's hard to see what the big picture is because I'm still stuck in the weeds.
Yeah. But right now it seems like what you're saying is you're kind of drawn, not magnetically, but you're drawn in a certain area. You're drawn to a certain path. It appears like.
Yeah. I'm drawn to certain themes, I realized. kind of conflicting identity, the themes of what people, how people want to portray themselves versus who they are on the inside, the generational struggles between parents and kids, the ways that we make assumptions about each other that are false and what the consequences of those assumptions are. I think those are the themes I'm still exploring in the second book.
Well, I wouldn't ask whether any of this is autobiographical, but I would ask, is that something that you see in the lives of your friends and the lives of the people you meet? Do you note it? And how can you discern it?
Yeah. So for me, I hate research. I know some authors like love research. I actually despise research. If I can make it up and not look it up, I will make it up. When I was thinking through, because I've been asked this before, you know, it feels like it is alchemy. So for example, Ivy's thieving and all of that. I mean, I was such a good kid. Like I never, you know, broke the rules. I never even missed class. So for me, I was really inspired because I had a really good friend. I think I was maybe in eighth grade and, you know, it was a really nice boy, very quiet. And then a few years later, I moved away, but an article came out about him. And essentially he had been organizing this entire like theft, like scam, where he would go into people's homes in the suburbs and like essentially steal things from their garages and sell them on eBay. And that, so actually I had all these scenes of Ivy and Rue doing something very similar, where they are essentially running a, you know, like a thieving scam of their neighbor's garages. So I just like little things like that. I don't know why they leave an impression on me. I've read this article when I was in high school, but they do. And so, and then when they all come together and they form a kind of a cohesive plot that supports the things I want to write about, that's how the story comes to me. So I can't say that it's not autobiographical, or it is. It really is just stories people tell me. And then, of course, with the Chinese culture thing, it's things from my experiences, from my Chinese American, but not even just Chinese American, just my immigrant friends or my American friends. Just little tics that people have, or if you know, if you catch someone in a lie, just like little things like where there's a, you know, there's a difference between what people say and what they mean. Just like little things like that that strike me that I'm really interested in capturing in the book that I work on.
When I was a kid, there was another kid I knew, but I knew not to hang around with him. What he said was, he would always look at the obituaries and read the funeral notices and when the funerals would be, because he could go to the house then because no one would be there.
Oh my gosh. I got asked a question, like, what was the inspiration for Rue and Gideon? And I, at first, my initial response was just, oh, I don't know, I just made up, like, it just came to me, right? But then I really started thinking about it, and I realized that the character Rue, the core of, like, you know, his kind of cockiness comes from when I was in third grade. I was living outside in these apartment complexes. I had a best friend, and she had an older brother who was way older than us, and he would ride his motorcycle like around town, and he would like park it in the parking lot. And he, you know, he was like dark haired and wore a leather jacket, and they were Eastern European. And then I thought, oh, that's where the image of Rue came to me from. But I had no idea, you know what I mean? It's very mysterious to myself. I always just say, yeah, I just came up with it. But there's probably little origins between all these little things, obviously, as any author would have.
Yeah, there are little things that happen in your life that would necessarily make it into a book. It's like one was these kids I used to put pennies on railroad tracks, or I'd put a dime on top of the penny, and then when the train ran over it, you know, it would thin it out, so you just had like a guitar pick kind of looking thing.
Well, they would actually melt together, like they wouldn't come apart. Oh, yeah. Wow.
Okay. Unless it was shaking too much. So I used to put chewing gum on the bottom of it and stick it to it. But this may be apocryphal, but there was these kids down there doing that, and one was there to touch the track with his tongue, and it was cold, and he got his tongue sucked to the track. And so one of the kids had to actually pee on his tongue in order to loosen his tongue from that.
See, that's the kind of thing that, you know what I mean? You would, it just leaves such a deep impression, and you might you like pluck it as a detail, right? To add to a character. That's so funny. Well, don't blame me if I use that story. If you read that detail.
I tell that to an author and they say they're going to put it in their book, I say, you have to give me either a dedication or a credit or, you know, some type of something. I do have a lot of, and the problem is that I do have a lot of these stories, but unlike you, I can do a narrative and I can do characters, but I have no beginning, middle, or end. And that's what I admire so much about you and many other authors, is that there is that. And like I said in the introduction, there is this curve. It's not a parabola necessarily, but there definitely is a curve as she goes through life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you. It's definitely hard. I think some people are like, they write very freely, so they don't know where they're going. They're writing and exploring at the same time. And then other people will outline everything. I feel like I definitely do a hybrid where I do have an overarching, like you said, the line of where the story's going, but the details are where it gets so messy, because you want to use them and you want it to feel authentic, but you still want it to fit the shape of the book and the vision that I had. And so many drafts with my editor went into kind of, smoothing those details out. And that's where, for me at least, a lot of the editing and the cutting and the adding all comes from, is putting those authentic details in while still staying on track to the story that I want to tell.
Okay. I think that's a good place to end it, because if we don't, I will talk more about me. I always do this too, and I really apologize. But
no, it's actually very refreshing. I feel like most of these interviews are like very, brusque, like Q&A.
Yeah, I know, because if you go on Good Morning America or even Terry Gross to a certain extent, So what's your book about? How did you come up with it?
Yeah.
What's your writing schedule?
I haven't been asked that one yet.
You'll get asked that 10 scores of times. And you'll also get options for Netflix. I can almost predict it.
Yes. I think something, but
good. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming today. I really enjoyed talking to you about your book, and it's great. It's so we've been talking to Susie Yang. Her book is White Ivy. It'll be out in the next few weeks in November by Simon & Schuster. And it's a great first novel, especially if you have a degree in pharmacy.
Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon.
Bye. Okay, bye.